There wasn't a lot of information. We did know that she had two siblings in Russia, and that they said that the reason she was being put up for adoption really was family hardship. Now, whether that was financial, you know, I don't really know. And certainly we can't ascertain the validity of what was in that document, but that's what was in there.
You're listening to the Just Sayin' podcast, offering conversations with experts that will educate, inform, and entertain. Here's your host of the Just Sayin' podcast, Charlie Cornaccio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Just Sayin' podcast, brought to you by New Leaf Hypnosis Center. At New Leaf, you'll be working with mindset coach and hypnotist Anthony Serino to overcome mental roadblocks holding you back from achieving your goals. Using a science-based and client-centered approach, Anthony will help you design the life you deserve. In episode 10 of the Just Sayin' podcast, we talked about my adoption, and I told you a quick version of my story and how I found my birth mother and the four brothers that I never knew I had, and hopefully you went out and you bought the book. Later in this episode, we're going to hear the other side of that story from one of the brothers who I met, who actually facilitated the meeting. But first, there are around 4 million babies who are born each year in the United States, and according to the Adoption Network statistics, around 140,000 children are adopted by American families. But some sources estimate that there are about 2 million couples currently waiting to adopt in the United States, which means there are as many as 36 waiting families for every one child to be placed in for adoption. Chris Rudolph and her husband Dave are one of the last American couples to adopt a baby from Russia, beautiful baby girl named Eliza. And Chris joins us now to talk about that arduous international adoption process and the conditions that these babies were being housed in when she got there. So Chris, thanks so much for joining us from your backyard. I wanted to make that known because that's not a, a virtual background. That's your backyard.
Yes, it is.
All right. Well, let's get right into it, because I think what happened was right after your adoption went through, Putin signed a law that said no Americans could adopt Russian babies any longer. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. It actually wasn't right after we adopted Eliza. That law changed in January 2013. Russia decided that no U.S. citizen could adopt a baby from Russia. So what we did get under the wire with was when we adopted Eliza 20 years ago, we needed to go to Russia one time to bring her home, whereas probably a month after our adoption was finalized, they then said you had to come twice. You had to come to Russia, I guess, so that they could meet you, meet the family. And then the parents had to come back to actually pick up the child and bring the child home to their new home.
Right. So you only did one trip.
Right.
Which is pretty convenient. How long were you there before you were able to take Eliza home?
We weren't there very long, actually. It was maybe it was 5 days. What was interesting about it is that we had to be ready almost like at a moment's notice, because whenever they said we could go, we had to be ready within a couple of days to go. So I remember we got the call. We thought it was going to be later. And then we got the call that it was within a week, we were going to Russia. So my husband and my dad quickly finished Eliza's bedroom, and I was packing diapers and everything else, getting ready to head off to Russia. So that's how it went.
Now, did you know it was Eliza before you got there?
The process then was for that agency to send you two, what were videotapes at the time, of two infants. And then you were to choose one of the infants, and that was the infant you were committing to. So we knew of her when we only saw her as an infant. So we obviously didn't know too much, probably had maybe 5 minutes of footage. Her name in Russia was Elizaveta. And so that's how we came to her name. We ended up just shortening her name and maintaining her name so that it just wasn't something she needed to think about, like, oh, I used to be this person and now I'm somebody else. So
right. Yeah. Did they give you any other background as far as like the family that she came from or the mother that she came from or anything like that?
They didn't give you a lot. I mean, they gave you maybe parents' pseudonyms. I don't know if they were the actual family names. What we could do, because when we got the video, probably when she was 2 weeks, a month old. And so during that interim, what we did was we took the video and we brought it to somebody who was kind of renowned in terms of specializing in adoptions and, you know, checking to see if, you know, as much as you can ascertain from a 5-10 minute video, if the baby appeared healthy or if there seemed to be, appeared to be any kind of neurological conditions or any kind of concerns. And so we had that done. And in terms of from Russia, no, there wasn't a lot of information. We did know that she had two siblings in Russia and that they said that the reason she was being put up for adoption really was family hardship. Now, whether that was financial, you know, I don't really know. And certainly we can't ascertain the validity of what was in that document, but that's what was in there.
What were the conditions like when you got there for the children who were going to be adopted?
Actually, the conditions were very good in Russia. It was certainly not it's not a home per se. I mean, I remember when we picked her up. Well, first of all, when we went there, we went and had some visitations with her before we could actually take her and bring her to an agency, the State Department in Moscow, and to officially adopt her. And it was a lot. So we had like kind of one-to-one visits, and then we went to pick her up. We got to see a little more of what was like on the inside. And it was basically like a large area with a lot of cribs, a big area for them to crawl around in. So there weren't a lot of toys or anything like that, but, you know, that wasn't surprising. But I would not say that, you know, she came from conditions that were really concerning to me, whereas I had volunteered at one point working with some orphans in Romania, and their conditions were very poor. But I did not find that the conditions in Russia, at least this particular baby home, and that's what they called it, was a baby home, was in any way poor or concerning.
Let's talk about the international adoption and why international as opposed to domestic here in the States.
That's a really good question. Actually, we had looked into both. We had originally wanted to look into a domestic adoption, but we had known some couples for whom the domestic adoption was interrupted. So the adoption was supposed to happen, then the biological mom or dad changed their mind, and so then the adoption didn't happen. And my husband and I both felt like if we were going to commit to something, we didn't want to have a baby in the home and then 2 weeks later, you know, the original family saying, we want the child back. We didn't want to do that. So we knew that for Russia, my husband's family lineage is in part Russian. So we felt like there was some lineage there. So it's in part why we did Russia, but we would have looked elsewhere as well. So that's why we did the international adoption, because that didn't happen during the international adoption.
I was going to ask you if you would have, you know, looking back now, if you would have done anything differently, but it sounds like you had a really good experience without any hitches. It seemed to work pretty seamlessly.
Yeah, it really did work out very well. I mean, there's a lot that we had to go through and a lot that any family has to go through if they're considering adoption. This home study, there's a lot that has to be done. But in the end, it was very worth it. And the adoptions for Russia at that time, it was not a process that was inordinately difficult. It was maybe more difficult than some other countries, I think, like maybe South Korea. I don't remember exactly, but it was not terrible. And we had an agency where the director was herself Russian. So there seemed to be a really good connection that she had with these particular baby homes. And yeah, it was pretty seamless.
Yeah. Go back, if you could, in your mind, and give us an appreciation of what you felt as a new mom? I know, you know, you're trying to have a baby. Let's say you can't have a baby. You want a baby so badly. And now you have this baby in your arms. What'd that feel like?
Well, it's funny. I think, you know, most people would expect you to say, you know, it was love at first sight. I was just overwhelmed. It was so beautiful. It was a moment of panic. You're like, oh, wow. Okay. And, you know, it's, I think it was like, okay, now what do I do? Suddenly you realize what you really don't know, which I think any new parents probably feel, but because when you're adopting, you're so in this forward motion of wanting to make it happen. You sometimes don't have time to think about, well, what's it going to be like when that second arrives? So it was definitely a moment of panic, but and then it was overwhelming love. She was just beautiful. We needed to form a relationship with her. You know, she had been being raised by others for almost 6 months. So she didn't know us. We were strangers. We were probably a little scary. Maybe we still are. I don't know. But so we had to kind of develop a relationship with her. One of the things that we did with her before we were able to take her home, which is kind of might be interesting, is that we ended up hiring what turned out to be a nurse who would visit her, I think it was 2 or 3 times a week, you know, an hour each time, to spend time with her so that she could attach to a person. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that can be concerning, particularly for international adoptions where there are multiple caregivers, is, you know, attachment, you know, because you're sometimes bringing a baby home, could be a toddler home, it could, you know, be an older child home. So that's one of the things we did for her that seemed to work out, and they ended up doing that for other children through this particular agency. So just something to think about in case anybody's going international, or just something to consider.
Let's talk about Aliza and give us how she's doing and how her life has been.
She's doing great. She really is. She's a typical, I guess, 20. Well, she's a 20-year-old now. She's in college. She's doing well. Went through all the typical milestones. You know, there are times when she can be difficult, and times when she's like an angel. She, you know, this is
teenager.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, she's 20, but you know, I think she's still in that older adolescent period. But she's been doing really great, and she's just been a joy to have in our lives. So we've been very lucky.
Yeah. As Aliza was growing up, how did you handle the information about her adoption, maybe her family, whatever you knew? What kind of questions did she have?
Well, families do it differently. Some families do not tell their adopted children that they are adopted. I don't recommend that at all. We talked about it for as long as Aliza was with us. Before she had words, we would talk about it so that she would be comfortable talking about it later. It's difficult for these children. I mean, they have the sense that they were abandoned by their biological parents. And I don't know that that's a loss that ever really goes away. But I think, you know, she's certainly attached to us as her parents. So she's comfortable talking to us about it and so forth. But I mean, Charlie, you'd know. I mean, it's something I think you probably grapple with your entire life, even if you were raised by a marvelous family. It's, you know, there's that question of why me? And, you know, it hurts. So,
yeah.
You know.
And I definitely felt that. I would say I was blessed because I got to see, what my life was like with my adopted parents, who were phenomenal. But I also got to see what my life would have been like after meeting my birth mom and my brothers and learning their stories growing up and realizing there were 4 boys all living in the same bedroom. And, you know, I had my own room. My sister had her own room. You know, it was pretty nice. And so you realize that, you know, before you know things, or if you don't know things, you're always thinking, oh, you know, my life probably would have been so much better. My parents probably had this nice house. We always think that way. We kind of glorify things, but usually not the case. So, yeah, I could see that. I definitely felt that myself, that sense of what happened and abandonment. Yeah. Full disclosure for those of you who are watching or listening, Chris actually inspired me to write the book, How I Met My Mother and the Four Brothers I Never Knew I Had. I would tell the story, you know, and just tell the story, and that was that.
Yeah,
and
right.
And I, you remember Chris was over the house with Dave and Aliza, and Chris said, "Hey, Charlie, tell Aliza your adoption story." Figuring, yeah. You know, Aliza, I think she was 14 at the time, whatever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I went through the whole thing, told the story, and as I'm telling the story, Aliza, 14-year-old kid, it didn't even look like she was involved or engaged. She wasn't like, "Oh, really?" You know, she was just, you know.
She was 14.
Yeah, she was 14, right. And so I didn't feel like she was even absorbing the story. But then you said something the next day. I don't know if you remember what you said, and if you could say it again. If not, I remember exactly what you said. But
you better tell me. I don't remember.
Well, the next day, you had said to me that Aliza had been at that stage in her life where she was wondering, you know, where I've come from, who, like, why they gave me up, why me, and, you know, not my other sisters or whatever. And that was before the story that I told that night. And then she got to a sense of feeling just kind of settled, where after she heard my story, she realized that she's where she's supposed to be. And that was pretty much the gist of my story, was we're always exactly where we're supposed to be. That's what God does. He puts us where we're supposed to be. And so she felt a sense of settlement. And what you said to me, which is why the book happened, was you said, you know, "Did you ever think of just writing that down?" I was like, no, I never did. It just so happens I had gotten laid off from my job, so I had time, which I had never had before. I was always running, you know, candle at both ends. And I sat down and wrote 58 pages in the first sitting, because it was just recounting. I wasn't developing characters or anything. I was just recounting the story. But it was because of that conversation and the impact it had on Aliza that I thought to myself, you know, other people could maybe get a sense of settlement from my story and feel, you know, feel that they're okay. And maybe it'll help other people. And that's kind of why I wrote it, but it was because of what you had said. So thank you for that.
Well, I will tell you that, you know, now that you're reflecting back, yes, you did, you know, give her kind of a sense of peace and calm about it. You know, she always wondered and still wonders, but to a lesser extent, what her life would have been like. And here she had you that got to see both sides. It's also interesting because she had kind of grappled with contacting the family. We'd said to her, "Look, we'll have the doc, and if you write a letter, we'll have it translated into Russian. I don't know if it's going to really get to this family. I don't know if the address is real. I don't know anything." And I think after she talked with you, she felt less of a need to do that. It was like, she'll think about it from time to time, but I think, I guess settled is the exact word. She's just more settled in where she is and who she is and what she contributes to the world and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, and that's, you got to take the internal value, and that's good that you say that, because you've got to realize what you're contributing to the world. And we're all contributing something.
Right.
And sometimes adopted people feel a little bit less than everybody else because of their situation, but we all contribute in some way, shape, or form. So I think that's really important for people to understand. The other thing too is there's so many stories out there that don't turn out good. And how heartbreaking would it be that you already have this doubt and why and all this other stuff, and then you finally meet your mother, and what if she doesn't want to talk to you? That would be horrible, right? So so save yourself from that. You know, you say to yourself, "Hey, this isn't so bad," you know.
and you know what? Aliza has said that. She said, "Suppose she doesn't want to talk to me."
Yeah.
You know, suppose I reach out to her and she never replies. Well, you know, what will that feel like? So she's thought about that.
Or she replies and then you can't get her out of your life and you don't like her. What if it's the other way around and you don't like her, and now you can't get rid of her? That was a fear. I'll tell you honestly, that was a fear I had when I was meeting my four brothers. My fear was, you know, I had this great family, extended family. And I thought to myself, what, you know, I'm fine where I'm at, but what if I don't like these guys? How do I shake them? And the blessing was that, you know, it turned out to be just great, you know, so we all like each other and it's good. But so there's that side too.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story from your vantage point, a couple who actually went out and adopted a child and brought her home and gave her a loving family, a loving life, great support. We know you guys, so I can attest to all of your parenting skills and everything else. You guys did a tremendous job. You really did. We love when we get together, and hopefully we'll get together soon. But thanks for sharing your story.
That sounds great. Oh, you're very welcome. Really a pleasure to do this, Charlie.
Now let's bring in the guy who made my reunion with my birth mother possible, a brother I first met when I was 38 years old. Michael Cosentino joins us on the Just Saying podcast. What are you doing?
What's so funny?
Wow, we look like brothers. How about that?
We hear that all the time, so we might as well continue it.
All right.
I got to shave. You don't mind,
dude. Yeah. You want to go shave and then come back?
All right.
There we go. All right. Michael.
Yes.
I talked a bit about you in episode 10, I believe it was, of the Just Saying podcast. I talked about you facilitating the whole thing of getting this whole thing rolling. But why don't you tell the audience what it was like from your perspective and how that whole thing began?
Well, take it back to the beginning. I always used to hear arguments taking place about somebody that my mother wanted to find as long as she lived. And at 9 or 10 years old, I had no idea what that meant. All I knew was that it was an argument. So I assumed, not knowing, being a child, it could have been a boyfriend. I have no idea. In reality, it was you. So time passed and we'd have family gatherings, and my mother had 4 children that she raised at home. And every time, which was a rarity that the family would get together, she'd be emotional. She'd cry and she'd hold these pink rosary beads. And, you know, it was kind of odd because here you are with your entire family. You should be happy. Why are you crying? And what we found out, as you know, later on was that there was one brother missing. And she knew that from birth, and that was a major problem for her. So, fast forward. I moved up to Hopewell Junction in December of 1980. I lived on a main road. My street was off of that road, as was yours, about 4 miles down the pike. My son played Pop Warner football. You filmed a number of his games. I ran into you at the Sons of Italy. I was the president. We were doing our annual donations. And we were giving an award to Cablevision, and you and Mike McCartney came. And after the meeting, I approached you and I said, you look just like my brother, my younger brother, Robert. And he had a mustache and the same hairdo. And a while later, I was playing softball at East Fishkill. You were filming all the events, the girls' softball, the men's football, softball. And I saw you in the dugout, and I probably annoyed you again. And I said, well, you know, you remember me? You definitely look like my brother, Robert. We have to be related. And then you started to question me, where I think you were trying to find out if I had an aunt. Maybe you were my aunt's son. You told me that your name was Paul Henry Cosentino when you were adopted. And I thought nothing much of it. So at that night, I think it was that night or the following night, you were broadcasting the sports section. And you showed all of the players on my team, the Sons of Italy team. And then you highlighted myself in the outfield, and you referred to me as your long-lost cousin. And I guess that just fell in line with thinking that maybe you were my father's sister's son. And that's what prompted my wife at that time, Betty, to speak to you, as you mentioned in your previous podcast, about, you know, Mary is my mother. And then we started to talk, and I remember vividly, you know, there was a lot of excitement and kind of awe. So that one thing led to another. And then we started to meet. We started to compare photos. And you looked a heck of a lot like Robert when you were young. But could be twins. And they say there's Irish twins. I think you guys were born 9 months apart. I forget how many months apart. Just about a year apart. So that would account for the great similarity. And then we started to really get serious, and I wanted to approach my mother, but she had just had knee surgery and a knee replacement, and I wasn't too sure about that. And she was really, she had a lot of medication in her. She was not herself. So I asked her, I said, tell me about the baby that died, because we were always told that, and she did. She had a miscarriage between you and Vinny. she says, oh, that baby died. I said, no, tell me about the other baby. And then she told me the whole story. For whatever reason, she just blurted it out. Maybe it was because she was on medication. I don't know. And
Let's just clear it up. She was on medication for a knee operation.
Yeah, right? She had a knee replacement, her second one. Actually, her fourth, because she had to replace both of them twice. I said to her, I think I may have found your son, at which point her eyes cleared and, you know, was like, don't play with me. Don't fool with me. And I'm not fooling. I have to ask you some questions. What did you name this baby and where did it happen? And I asked her all that baloney. And she told me that it was Misericordia Hospital in the Bronx. It was 19. She wasn't certain. She believed it was 54, which it was. She told me that my father and her were really not happily married or together, and she had a what was perceived to be a pregnancy outside the marriage. So in the, especially West New Rochelle, which is all Italian, you can't have that visible. So what they would do is they would move you into a hospital, and she was in Misericordia Hospital for 4 or 5 months when she started to show her pregnancy, and the nuns took care of her. They delivered the baby. It was you. And out of here, like, you know, I don't know how many times after she found you. Michael, I'll never forget, he had these ice blue eyes. And I said, well, so did Damien in the movie The Omen. I mean, what does that mean? I have blue eyes, okay? So I asked her about the name. I said, where did you get the name Paul Henry? Because no one in our family has that name. And she told me that in those days, the head nurse in the maternity ward was Sister St. Paul, and her assistant was Sister St. Henry. So therefore, she named you Paul Henry. And then when I told you that, I mean, I think that solidified everything, because it's like, well, here's a birth certificate, here's the year, here's the hospital. The baby's name was Paul Henry. The mother's name was Mary Costantino. Do we need more evidence?
Right. But what happened was, after you told me that story, I called Misericordia, and I was completely open with them. And I said, I think that my birth mother may have found me, and I want to make sure. And we went through some code they used to use back in the day of if it was my mother or not based on the name. They would use take the first letter of the last name and create another name out of it. So it was Mary Cora. And that was on my record. So okay. I said, Mary Cora. And she said, yeah, you were born here. And so I said, well, I'm just trying to get information. Can you tell me who ran the ward? There was a sister who ran the ward. She said, oh, well, that would be Sister St. Paul. And I said, do you have an assistant? Oh, yeah, Sister Henry. And so that was pretty much the solidifying thing that then, you know, when we got together, and I'll say this to the people who have been adopted and just don't know, and you never feel completely connected if you know that you were adopted, and the family could be great. Mine was, but you know, in all the pictures, you don't look like anybody, you know, it's all that stuff. When we sat down and compared photographs at a McDonald's on Route 9 in Wappingers, it was the first time in my life that I had ever seen anyone who looked like me, to the point where we were pulling out photos and they were all taken around the same time period.
From birth.
From the 50s and, you know, early 60s. Got to a point where we started to mix up whose pictures were whose because there were so many similarities. That was thrilling for me because I had never had that before.
I think my sister-in-law, Mary Ann, I think she made a comment once asking you why you were on TV. When in reality, it was me.
Yeah.
And I was being interviewed, I think, about the upcoming Sons of Italy Festival.
Right. So we had our meeting, and I kind of knew it was you, but Marianne had not met you yet. And it was after that Sons of Italy Festival, you're having a recap of how much money you made, where you donated it to, and you were one of the guests on the show being interviewed. And I sat down with Marianne because I knew it was on. I turned it on, and she said, when did you start doing this show? And I said, that's not me. And she's like, oh my God, that's him. She jumped up across the room and was like inspecting the TV and looking at me, and like the similarities were incredible.
Yeah.
I got a question for you. I showed the picture, and I'll show it again, of the five brothers together when we first met at your house. Uh-huh. And I met the brothers. Coincidentally, everybody had a mustache at the time, which we looked like the Marx Brothers, right? When you told them that, you know, this whole thing went down, what was their reaction and how did you say it to them?
Well, I pretty much, you know, told them the background and then that we had met and that we, at that time, you had met Mom.
Right.
It varied. It's amazing. When I told Vinny, who's the youngest, he was on cloud nine until this day. He was like, oh my God, I have a brother and, you know, we're a family, because he's very into family. I told Robert and he thought I was fooling. And Robert is the one that I think looks the closest to you. And it really, and I said, listen, just sit still and I'm going to probably have a barbecue at the house and we'll have them over and we'll talk. And then I told Lewis, who at that time did not have a very good relationship with my mother or the brothers at all. I mean, it was horrible. Later on in life, him and my mother became extremely close, which made her ecstatic. And, you know, then he unfortunately passed from stomach cancer.
Well, he was suffering from PTSD, wasn't he, from Vietnam?
Yeah, that was all. They say it's Agent Orange and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
So when I told him, he was like not even interested. No, but he came. And then we met in the garage.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a lot of questions. And Vinny, of course, well, what are you doing? You know, Vinny, calm down, okay? And Robert would smile and laugh, and he understood. Lewis was just I always remember him as being, you know, okay, well, I don't know if I want to continue with it. Well, you know, you're going to get that, I think, in an adoption. Not everybody's going to say, hey, great, this is the best news I've ever heard, and we're going to be together and all that. And Lewis, but I think I told you back then, you can't hold that against Lewis because he feels that way about us. You know, he felt that way about us and his mother. He had a major chip on his shoulder. We think a lot of it had to do with Vietnam. I remember having a coming home party for him and some of the balloons started to pop and he literally dove under a table.
Wow.
So I think he was, you know, not too balanced at that time. We followed up with another get together in which my mother was there. Your mother was your adopted mother was there, your adopted sister was there and her husband and the child, and then we went over to the local ball field and played baseball.
Right.
Even stepdad Bob Ball got up there and hit the ball and ran to first base, and you know that was so much fun for him because he was a AAA minor league ball player, so he was strutting.
You talk about adoption stories, reunion stories, where things don't turn out that great, where families are, you know, a little bit distant, and I don't want them in my life. I've got, you know, my stuff going on. I don't need this headache or whatever, you know, whatever it is. We were blessed that it was good from the get-go and has been good since. We've been together for parties. We've been together for birthdays. We've been together for weddings. And it has been truly a blessing. It really has, the way it turned out. But the coincidences, and this is one of the things that, you know, people, it's in the book. Got to get the book. The coincidences of all of the times where our paths crossed.
Right.
So here's an example, and I didn't mention it in the last episode, but Michael and his family lived in New Rochelle. I worked in New Rochelle. Michael's father had a dry cleaning business on Main Street, and I used to, on my lunch hour, walk Main Street. I would walk by his dry cleaners, and the reason I knew that was because of the chemical smell that you would smell as you got closer to it, so I remembered that. Mary's apartment building where she lived had a baseball, softball field that you could see out from her fourth floor window. I played on that field in an industrial league in New Rochelle. You move 65 miles away to Dutchess County. I move to Dutchess County, where like off the same road, about 2 miles apart from each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, just so many coincidences.
Sure. You know, just to get back to the baseball, I and Robert played on the same team in that industrial league. And I would venture to say we must have played against you because we played like Tuck Tape. I can't remember all the teams, but we played for People's Bank.
Oh, okay.
Robert worked there. I don't know how we researched that, but, you know, on that same field and other fields around New Rochelle, City Park and so forth. But I would bet we probably played each other. I may have tagged you out at third trying to steal. because that's how good I was, you know. But and then, of course, we went to play baseball together. You that convinced us to play hardball. Yeah. Even got us our own autographed wooden bats. Right. That the first time I used it, it cracked. But I remember it was just awesome.
I just want to say we've got a great story to tell. We got a happy ending. And for the record, I am so glad that we found each other and that you were watching the news and saw the connection. Mm-hmm. And then we met at the Sons of Italy awards dinner, because you are exactly what I wished I had as a brother when I was a kid growing up. And every kid wants a brother if you don't have one. But you are exactly what I had wished for. And I just wanted to say that
that's
publicly.
Me? Because typically people say, we don't want you here. You know, we really don't. Let me bring up just one more thing. It's really interesting because we became the first in the family to meet. But even today, our children and our grandchildren have a great relationship. Example, my son is closing on a new house. Your son, Adam, is going to do the mortgage. And he's not even in the area. I mean, it's really weird. Kimberly and Jessica and Michelle and Brian, they're all friends. Right. And it's really amazing. And what really gets me sometimes is I'll walk into a supermarket. I did this maybe 6 months ago when I ran into Jessica and one of the girls, and I forget which one it was. And it was Uncle Mike and this and that and smiling and hugging and kissing. Wow, and it still feels at times like it's still in the early 90s when all this happened.
Right.
You know, all these reasons happened.
Yeah. Strange. Amazing stuff. Amazing story.
Yeah, it is.
You know, I have fun telling it, and I'm sure you do as well, and that's because of the similarities, the coincidences, and the ending, the way the ending turned out.
Right.
It was so good. So,
yep.
Anyway, Michael, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Podcast.
Appreciate it.
And I'm sure I'll catch up with you in about a month or so once we get up to New York.
Yep. Okay.
All right.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Good luck with the podcast.
Thanks. And tune in next week as baseball season begins. A musician wrote a perfectly timed song about the New York Yankees. Vito Petrosito will join us to talk about how that song came to be. In the meantime, thanks to New Leaf Hypnosis Center for sponsoring the Just Sayin' podcast. Stay safe and be kind. And be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode of the Just Sayin' podcast. We'll see you next time.